This is the Forces Station. This is BFBS.
BFBS. Original Forces Programs.
World Cup 66. 50 years of hurt.
Hi, I'm Jason Webster, and I'm taking a look back at England winning one of the world's biggest footballing competitions back in 1966. 50 years ago, England lifted the World Cup in Wembley in front of nearly 97,000 people. It was a hot July afternoon, the Trogs were at number one in the charts, and it was a day full of cheering and excitement, which made football fans all over the country feel the love for the beautiful game. I want the whole tournament holds great memories, and it's a time that sports broadcaster Jeff Stelling will never forget.
I was already in love with football, to be honest, by the time of the World Cup. You know, I was already your regular Hartlepool supporter, but, you know, to see England play and win the World Cup was just incredible. And, of course, the big thing about it was, you know, the World Cup was taking place almost on my doorstep, because I remember games were taking place at Middlesbrough's home ground, which was then Ayresome Park, you know, which is just a handful of miles away. And North Korea, of all teams, were playing there. They played some of their group games there against the likes of Italy. So, you know, you felt like you were part of this World Cup experience, and that was incredible for an 11-year-old boy. And I think that's what really got me hooked into the World Cup. And of course, as it went on, and England were doing better and better and better, you know, it just became an unforgettable experience. And I can see it, you know, in my mind's eye right now, in full colour, of course, because I watched it in black and white, because a lot of TVs in those days were black and white, but it didn't ruin the enjoyment. You know, still one of the greatest sporting memories of my lifetime.
What was the atmosphere like in England on the day? It must have been a huge buzz.
Well, it was, but the streets were empty. I watched it in Hartlepool. The streets were absolutely deserted because everyone was inside, you know, watching the football. It was a ghost town. But afterwards, carnival atmosphere, obviously, you know, England had won the World Cup, and it was something that... Well, I wouldn't say it wasn't unexpected, because, you know, we'd gone into it with a really strong side, and we'd gone into it with home advantage as well. But the joy of beating West Germany in the final, well, it was absolutely joy unabated, to be brutally honest. So I didn't think that in my lifetime so far that would be the last time we win the World Cup, by the way. I thought there'd be many more to come, but there haven't been. And that's just a reflection of just how fantastic, you know, Jeff Hurst and Martin Peters and all the boys who played that day were. Keep on running. Keep on hiding. One fine day I'm gonna be the one to make you understand. Oh yeah, I'm gonna be your man.
Sir Alf Ramsey was the brains behind the World Cup win in 1966. And from the start, the England team only had one objective in their sights.
The obvious question was put to me whilst I was fighting to get my breath. How will England do in the World Cup, or how will England get on in the World Cup competition? And I said, win it. And I suppose this was a source of embarrassment to me for the next 3 years, because every time I was interviewed, no matter by whom, I was asked that the final question was, do you still think you'll win the World Cup? And of course one had to say yes. But having said it, I think it was the right thing to say. It turned out the right thing to say. It was a good thing to say, regardless of the embarrassment. This was the only thing that mattered. We never talked about losing. We didn't have to play attractive football. All we had to do was to win six matches, six consecutive matches. Whilst England didn't do this, they drew the first match. They had to win the next five consecutive matches, and this was all we concentrated on. We weren't concerned with playing attractive football. We weren't concerned, and I say this with embarrassment, we weren't concerned with entertaining the public. We were concerned with winning the World Cup because of the importance of winning the World Cup for England at that particular time. And we found goals difficult to come by. And I think when you look at the goals that England scored, I can think in terms of the four that Jeff Hurst scored and the three that Bobby Charlton scored. Now, these were magnificent goals. These goals were poetry in themselves, in that if you wrote about them, if you tried to plan these sort of things, you know, there was so much in them. They were so beautifully taken that they had to go where they went. They had to be struck in the manner in which they were struck. And there was so much poetry in these seven goals. Goals were hard for us to come by. And then we had the quarter-final match against the Argentine, which was probably our most difficult match. It was an unpleasant match, a match that possibly was ought to be forgotten. But the next two matches, of course, were the highlights of the World Cup competition. The match against Portugal was possibly the best game in the competition, most certainly the best match that, or the best game that England was involved in.
Kenneth Wolstenholme was the voice of the tournament. From his perfectly timed one-liners to his encapsulating descriptions of the atmosphere within the stadium.
No previous international, no other cup final, indeed nothing Wembley ever staged, matched the glamour of this event, the final of the World Cup. The cream of the world's players battle for the honour of playing on this arena on this afternoon. Waiting in the tunnel were England on the right and West Germany. When the moment came for the players to march out, 97,000 fans gave them the biggest roar of the competition.
From one legendary commentator to another, John Motson has watched hundreds of England games over the years and thinks Kenneth Wolstenholme moulded the way commentary is done today.
Well, I think he was the only out-and-out BBC commentator at the time. Nobody else had really come through because there wasn't enough football probably for them to do. I think he'll always be remembered, obviously, for his last sentence. You know, they think it's all over, it is now. Although that didn't become his trademark or didn't become that memorable on the day, as I recall. It came a bit later on. But certainly he was a trailblazer in that that was the way commentary was done for many years. And then, of course, all the rest of us followed in his footsteps, really. So yes, I think he did set the trend, but obviously as commentary moved on, then it was done probably slightly differently by some of us.
And here comes Hurst. He's got some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now. It's four.
Is there a part of you, though, that wishes that you had been doing the voice of the World Cup 66 final then?
Well, I suppose so. Although, to be honest with you, I was still working on the local weekly newspaper at that time and hadn't considered myself as ever becoming a BBC commentator. But obviously, as time went on and I joined the Match of the Day team, I was lucky enough to be involved in 9 or 10 World Cups myself. So, in a way, I really did sort of follow his trail, so to speak.
World Cup 66. 50 years of hurt.
They say it's every boy's dream to play for their country, which Sir Jeff Hurst says is as true now as it was 50 years ago.
You can only talk about the time you played, and I think it's disappointing from an England perspective. We haven't, apart from 90, we were close, done well over the last 50 years. And you go back just a couple of years in Brazil was hugely disappointing, where we were out before we finished qualifying. And particularly from the young players, I think, that we do need some performances that they're showing at their clubs to be showing those kind of performances collectively in the finals. And if I look back to our time in the final in 66, we had the youngest player in our squad, a young man called Alan Ball, 20, 21 years of age. He was the man of the match in the final. That was the kind of performance he gave as the youngest player. And he once said famously to Alf Ramsey, after a few caps, "If you want this shirt back, Alf, you're going to have to tear it off my back."
England vice-captain Gary Cahill has been a prominent member of the current squad for a few years, but he didn't always think he'll be able to achieve his dream to play for his country.
I think when I thought, like, not that I had a chance, but I think when I started playing, first of all, training at Aston Villa with the first team on a regular basis, first of all, I weren't looking ahead to kind of skipping the Premier League to go and play international football, but I was training there thinking, if I work hard, I can be on the level that these guys are on. That was the first kind of time I felt accepted playing at that level. And also at the time there was people like Leandri. I mean, I was growing up, when you're in any YT or youth academy, obviously one watched the first team, so I went to watch, like, you know, Gareth Southgate, who was playing regularly for England, And then when I got in the first team, Leandro was on the verges, Gareth Barry was in there. So to play in amongst these guys and feel like you're nearly there in that level, then that was probably the first glimpse of hope that I had of maybe going on to greater things. But I knew that would be a long time to come.
Sports presenter Charlie Webster knows how playing for England is a real privilege, and the England ladies squad is just as keen to lift the World Cup and to follow in the 1966 team's footsteps.
There's no animosity if one of the players isn't getting the minutes on the pitch, and that the bench is supporting the team on the pitch the whole time, and there's that tactical intelligence, and there's the spirit, and they share rooms as well. They bunk up and share rooms, and the fact that they have the character and they're all getting on, which I know is not maybe on the pitch, but I think it's so important because we see that so many times in the male game, the ego of players not getting on. I remember when I worked at Real Madrid, like, gosh, must have been 10 years ago, and they had the best individual players ever, but none of them got on. There was a split dressing room and they didn't win a thing. And I think that's really key with the England team now is, yes, they've got the tactical intelligence and they've worked so much on the football side of the game, as in tactics, but they've also worked so hard on spirit, and they've seen numerous sports psychologists and spent so many working hours with them and motivational experts, and I think it's really paid off. And I think that's a new era of football, of the game, not just the women's game.
A lot of players focus more on their club football now than wanting to play for England or play for their national team. But I think for the women's football, it seems they really want this.
I actually think that they do, and I know there's been so many reports where a lot of players have said that they prefer to play for their, you know, domestic club, and they're not too bothered about playing for their country. And, you know, people have been critical of them, as in money talks, and it's about money, and that's where they get it from, the domestic side. But I don't know many players that wouldn't dream of playing for their country, especially when they're in their youth academies, when they're young. If you speak to a lot of these under-18s that are playing in the youth academies or the youth teams, I think their dream would be to play for England.
World Cup 66. 50 years of heart. I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colours anymore, I want them to turn black.
Wembley is the home of English football, but it's a very different looking ground from 50 years ago, as tour guide Adam Burridge explains. In December 2002, the iconic towers were demolished and work on the new stadium begun.
The new stadium is on exactly the same spot of land where the old Wembley was. Still runs the same axis, still runs east to west. So we know it's the same place, obviously, that England won the Cup in 66. There's one good marker inside the stadium that points that out is the grey commentary box up at the top there. Now, we know the broadcasters were insistent that when the new Wembley was built, they wanted the TV gantry to be the same height that it was at the old stadium, and that the old stadium, famously Sir Kenneth Wolstenholme, with arguably the most famous piece of commentary of all time, that's where he would have been, because the cameras wanted to be in the same place, so the old Wembley felt like the new Wembley. So we know the top line of that grey box is the roof of the old stadium, so this building is a much, much bigger stadium than it ever was. The footprint is way larger than it ever would have been. Inside the bowl especially, the old stadium, as many of your listeners will remember, you had the running track around the outside. So the track was put in really for three things. One for Speedway, very, very famous at the old stadium. The second one for the Olympics in 1948. This was obviously the running track, and this was the Olympic Stadium. And the third one is for the biggest sport we've ever had, which is greyhound racing. Without the dogs, there's no Wembley. Wembley would have finished in the 1960s. The greyhounds was guaranteed revenue twice a week for the best part of 40 to 50 years. So that kept us going, and when you think of the differences between the old and new stadium, we're stood by the players' tunnel now. The old players' tunnel was behind the eastern goal. So the players would walk out from behind the goal, that very long walk across the field, across the track, of course, and then line up here to be introduced to the royal party. A lot of big differences now. Every view inside the new Wembley is perfect. Every seat has an uninterrupted view of the field. Obviously, that didn't happen at the old Wembley because you had those enormous columns holding up the roof. In 1923, that was considered state-of-the-art architecture. Now, you know, every seat has to be absolutely perfect because people are paying good money to come here and watch the games. So every single seat has an uninterrupted view. Every seat has more legroom than the old Royal Box. So when Bobby Moore made his way up the 39 steps to lift the World Cup and was presented it by Her Majesty the Queen, she had less legroom in the Royal Box than every single seat, all 90,000 seats in the new Wembley Stadium.
The England teams of today have a lot to live up to with this new stadium, but they have plenty of inspiration as they walk from changing rooms to pitch side.
The famous shot there of Bobby Moore on Sir Geoff's shoulders and Ray Wilson's shoulders just there. The stadium obviously behind there, but it was a very, very quick process after the game. Nowadays you'll get the staged photo shots and there's the lap of honour with the sponsors, but back then you walked up to the Royal Box, you got the cup, gave it a lift, back down, show it to everybody and then off you go. But the great thing is now in the current stadium, this sits as the last thing the England team see before they step out into the building. So, and it's 50 years, of course, as we know. So, no pressure for the England team and Wayne Rooney and Joe Hart and Harry Kane as the guys walk past. The last thing they see is the greatest ever achievement in English football. So, that's what they have to live up to. That's the level.
We are in the England dressing room then. Yep. Lots of shirts up there. I mean, here is Kane. Why hasn't he got his own hand now?
Where the shirts are shows you exactly where the players would sit.
Oh, really?
So when we first opened in 2007, the England manager at the time was Steve McLaren. And what he wanted was that the first 11 would sit on these two sides just here and the substitutes would sit on that side just there. What that then does is it still creates a team ethic inside of this room. But what it also does is it gives you something psychologically to attain to for the next match. Because if you're starting, you're kind of where you need to be. Mm-hmm. But for these guys who aren't starting, they need mentally for the next game thinking,
we want to be there. Outside, yeah.
That's the level. And that starts from all through the managers, all through from Fabio Capello. So yeah, it's a great bit of psychology. It works very nicely.
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. They're appealing for offside. The ball came back off the foot of Steve Hodge and Maradona gives Argentina the lead.
Wait a minute, he's taking another card out for Beckham. It's a red card for David Beckham. Oh no. So Beckham is out of the game.
They didn't think it went over the line in 1966. That definitely went over the line by a yard. And Scolari, somehow or other, has put it across Ericsson in England in a quarter-final for the third time. And this will be Sven-Göran Eriksson's last game in charge of the England team.
Since 1966, England have had a varying degree of success. But as John Motson and former England players Emil Heskey and Jermaine Genus explained, they haven't quite made it all the way to lift the cup again.
I think England have been a bit unlucky in some World Cups, to be perfectly honest. I mean, we took Germany very, very close in that quarter-final in 1970, didn't we? And then there was the Ron Greenwood team that came back unbeaten in 1982. Well, we could go on forever, couldn't we, really? I mean, the team that Sven-Göran Eriksson had was called the Golden Generation, and then, of course, Wayne Rooney was sent off and Michael Owen got injured, so that blew 2006 out the window. There have been times when you've thought to yourself, goodness, England might get to the final this year, and I've left the best till last, of course, 1990 in Turin, when England lost on penalties to Germany, having drawn 1-1 after extra time. I mean, that team, that was the team of Gary Lineker, of course, and Peter Beardsley and Paul Gascoigne, who made his name, of course, by bursting into tears in the semi-final. I mean, they were that close, really, to beating Germany, and if they had, I think they would have beaten a weakened Argentina in the final. So really, it seems a lot of 50 years seems an awful long time, but there have been moments in that period when England could have got to the final.
We had some good, really good players, but we was a unit. We was a really strong unit, and a lot of players that you would have thought would have retired earlier, but the 5-1, everyone's going to remember. That 2002 World Cup was great. we weren't ready to go out of the tournament when Brazil, you know, we went 1-0 up that Brazil. But, you know, when Brazil went on to win it, you're looking at it and saying, all right, well, at least we lost to the eventual winners. And the goal that they Ronaldinho scored, I watched it so many times, and I'm still in two minds whether he actually meant it or not.
Oh, and Seaman's been beaten. It's a goal. It's Ronaldinho.
I just think playing for your country is just something different. Yeah. There's no feeling like it. I was speaking to someone about it the other day, actually, when we was at the game, and there's something about, you know, when you line up for your country at Wembley and that whole stadium sings that national anthem, and you know that everybody in the whole country is watching that game, and if they're not watching it, they're listening to it. But I just think winning the World Cup, I mean, can you imagine bringing home the World Cup to England? What it would be like? I'm pretty sure that everyone would have a week off work at least, so it'd be absolutely phenomenal, wouldn't it?
You know, you watching the game the other day, did you get itchy feet and think, oh, I wish I was playing right now?
Oh, of course. I mean, like, when I look at the England team now, I came from a completely different generation. I mean, my competition when I was coming into the England squad was Paul Scholes, Nicky Butt, Gerrard, Lampard, you know, Carrick, Danny Murphy. You know, the level I felt was as an England squad, it was pretty peak at that time. You know, Scott Parker's, there was me, there was Aaron Hargreaves. I mean, the list was endless when it came to getting into that squad. So, you know, when I look at it now, you do look at it and go, oh, you know, I'd love to be playing in that team. I feel like I would probably have got more caps if I was playing now and so on. So but you just can't look at it like that. You know, I had my opportunity, and luckily enough, I got 21 caps under my belt, scored a goal at Wembley, and you know, I was delighted to be, you know, a part of the Germany World Cup campaign when we got to the quarterfinals. So you know, my England career was mixed in terms of the way I felt about it, but you know, loved every minute of it.
World Cup 66, 50 years of hurt.
The taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon, and I can't sail my yacht. He's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny afternoon.
Football has massively changed since England won the Cup 50 years ago, but Sir Geoff Hurst says it's a simple game. You've just got to find the best ways to win.
In terms of injuries, I think you've got to be playing regularly coming into the tournament and providing, and along with everybody else for that matter, that they've been playing a few games and their fitness-wise is good coming into the time when he has to select his squad, will be OK. If there is a doubt about any player that he's not going to be fit by the time the tournament starts, then they shouldn't be taken, whoever they are, because you do not want to be carrying an injured player going into the tournament, no matter how good or bad they are. I think that's not a good policy. And they all have to be fit and well. There were two criteria in Alf Ramsey's day. One, you were playing regularly for your club. It didn't matter how you were playing, as long as you were playing, because once he picked them, he didn't tend to worry too much about their club form, providing they did it for him. And secondly, that they weren't arguing over a contract. It wasn't a contractual issue. And they were two pretty clear criteria, which I'm not sure where they stand today, but it's important you're fit anyway.
Now, you must have been asked the story about the World Cup so many times. Let me ask you something now, Geoff.
Is this going to be a new question? Wow.
I don't know. Would you rather today's players' wages or £1 for every time you've been asked about the World Cup in 66?
I think a player's wages sound good.
I mean, you must have been asked a lot of times, though, about World Cup 66.
Yes, it probably amounts to the player's wages today, yeah. I think it's remarkable because at the time you're not aware of the magnitude of the occasion. It's only many years later leading up to today, really, and will go on for the rest of my life, where people will talk about their day and remembering where they were and what they were doing, some fantastic stories. And that's really the enjoyment of winning a World Cup. That people's experiences, and you realise how big it is, and it's a national event. It transcends the sport. It's a national event, whether it's any sport. People who, because it's national, people who are not necessarily totally follow football are involved in wanting to show some interest in it. I mean, is it 25, 30 million people watched it? Maybe had it been a lesser competition, you wouldn't see so many people. It's a national event and people still talk about it.
Today's England players have constant pressure on their shoulders with having to live up to the standard of the 1966 team. If Gary Cahill and this England team were up against the World Cup winning squad, who would win?
It's impossible to compare. It's so different. Even just watching it as a boy, even me watching it for like even games that are, you know, you get the black and white games, don't you? And obviously I was never even around, and, you know, 40 years ago, and you watch it and it's so different. The stadium, the pitch, the equipment, the balls, everything.
I mean, if you could plant the 1966 team in their guise as they were then and say, for example, the fitness levels were equal, then I think they would give the present team a very good game, because obviously there were some great players in 1966, Bobby Moore, Bobby Charlton, Jeff Hurst and so on. So in that respect, I think they probably would hold their own. But of course, they were playing at a time when even the formations were different. I mean, we had... We're just getting into 4-2-4 and 4-3-3. In fact, Alf Ramsey adopted a 4-3-3 formation at a fairly short time before the World Cup itself. So that was all still happening. And I think, to be honest with you, the laws of the game have been a bit different now. I mean, the pass back to the goalkeeper, the tackle from behind, the way they've played around with the offside law. A lot of things have altered in the laws of the game and therefore in the way it's played.
I used to sometimes say to my granddad or whatever when they'd bring up a player from back in the day, and then I'd bring up a present player, and you have that little one where he's like, he'd say, "Ah, oh, he couldn't lace his boots," and all this kind of stuff. I know where they're coming from, because they grew up in that era and I've grown up in this era, so it would be interesting to see, but I would know by no means disrespect that England team and say that they would get beat by anybody, because it's an England team that's gone down in history and will be remembered for forever, really.
Looking forward at the future of the England team, could we actually win again?
I'd certainly like to think so, yeah. I'd certainly like to think so. I'm sure it'll happen at some stage.
Some stage soon?
Again, you like to think so, wouldn't you? It's hard to say that, like, because, like I said, of how hard it is to do. So I'd just like to say I'm sure it'll happen at some stage. You know, they come round so few and far between, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's the thing. You're involved in one. If you're involved in two, fantastic. You know, some guys that have been involved in three or whatever is incredible as a footballer to achieve something like that. So I'm sure it'll happen.
In your dream scenario, if it was up to you, you get to the final, who would you love to be playing against? Would you either go for a team that's got there through luck more than anything and then actually smashed them, or you'd be up against a good team that you'd like to...
I think you're guaranteed to be up against a good team if they've made the final. You know, somebody like a Germany as a massive fixture for England v Germany is obviously a huge fixture. England v Brazil, because you know how much Brazil and Brazilian players bring to football and their reputation in the game. So if he was to go and play someone like that, win, obviously it'd be icing on the cake, but I'd take anyone, mate, for that.
Listen to this. Germany 1, England 5.
Beckham could raise the roof here with a goal. I don't believe it. David Beckham scores the goal to take England all the way to the World Cup Finals.
It's time for Wayne Rooney. 50 up for England. For England's all-time leading goal scorer, it's Wayne Rooney's record breaker.
Moore, chip down Hurst, a chance, a goal! It's there! Hurst.
What we saw in our stop frame. It is a goal. It is a goal. They've given it.
And here comes Hurst. He's got some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now.
After 50 years of hurt since the glory days in 1966, you just want to believe that one day England will win the World Cup again.
BFBS, Original Forces Programmes. On digital radio, FM and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air, around the world.
This is the Forces Station.
BFBS.